This is Coffee with Kelly, a dynamic podcast that's dedicated to driving positive change in school safety. I'm your host, Ethan Woodman, product marketing specialist for Crisis Go. And I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Kelly Moore, senior school safety specialist for Crisis Go. Our mission is to empower you with essential knowledge, tools, and inspiration required to foster a safer and more secure school environment. We hope this podcast will be the catalyst for transformation in your schools. Join us as we continue to dive into the world of school safety.
Good morning, Kelly. I want to tell you something real funny that happened to me this morning. So I was doing my...
Is it going to actually be funny or is it just funny to you and you're hoping that I...
So funny story. We're actually looking for new co-host guys. I'm kidding. So I was doing my regular, you know, coffee making routine. And so I have a burr grinder. So it's one like the two plastic parts grind the beans. So that way it doesn't burn them. So it tastes a lot better. So, and then there's like a little plastic bucket that goes in there that's supposed to catch all the grounds. And, you know, because I've been getting probably about 2.5 hours, maybe 3 hours of sleep on average for the past, I don't know, month because of a 7-month-old that does not want to sleep.
Awesome.
So I'm very tired most of the time. So I'm just doing my regular coffee routine and, you know, I do you spin the dial like a, I'm like one of those like old timers and I turn that and it's going, I'm getting all the other stuff ready and I go to grab the bucket out of my burr grinder and there's no bucket in there. So I ground the beans with no bucket in there. So
they're all over the counter?
They were all over the counter.
Awesome.
So that was my morning this morning.
Yeah, I don't have that problem. You know why?
Because your kids are not 7 months old.
Nope. I buy cheap coffee. It's already ground.
Ugh.
And then I make the best coffee out of it.
Guys, don't do this. Don't.
Cowboy coffee.
You gotta get the whole bean and grind it yourself. That's how you gotta do it.
You don't. That's the coffee industry lying to you.
No, it's just...
That's all fake science.
It's real science. It's real science behind it, Kelly.
I will tell you, I have turned some pretty big snobs into converts of the cowboy way.
I think they were just trying to be nice. They didn't actually change.
I would say that if they didn't continue it, they do it all the time.
Really?
If they had made it once or make it once when I'm in their presence, I get it. But some people make it all the time. I'm one of them. All right, what do we got today?
So I don't even have a burning question for you at the end.
You'll think of one. Or you're going to think of many based upon our topic today.
Okay, we'll come up with one. But anyways, so
yep.
In our In the News section. Mm-hmm. So this is actually not in the U.S. This is an event that happened in Finland. I think it was about a day ago, maybe a little over 24 hours. I'm not 100% sure, but it's around that time frame. So in short, basically a 12-year-old boy went into his school and shot three of his classmates who were also all 12 years old. And I was reading in an article posted just about an hour ago, and as you would have probably guessed, the kid obviously was put into custody because they grabbed him, but they were asking him questions, obviously, and they said, "Hey, you know, why'd you do this?" And the answer is, "I was bullied."
Mm-hmm. Are you surprised?
It blows my mind that something so I feel like it's something so simple to solve if we really worked at it would cause something to that extreme. It would push a 12-year-old to do that. So
yeah, this is a discussion we could go on for weeks, months, years, so forth, right? And here is the issue with bullying. We've talked about it ad nauseum about bullying and what it is, but I'm going to bring it to a little bit more fundamental level. And bullying is when somebody comes to a situation from a position of power, right? We've talked about that before.
Yeah.
And I want you to do something because I have the power to make you do it, or the perceived power, right? So bullying is often done in groups, not necessarily just one-on-one, but fundamentally, it's in our DNA. Survival of the fittest.
Mm.
And bullying is a manifestation of that, is I am powerful. I am the one who has the power to do this and make you do what I want to do because I am the fittest, right? So trying to socially engineer that kind of thing out of nature is a difficult thing to do. It's not easy. You know, we see that other than in the human species, we see it in almost every other species. I say almost because I'm not a scientist, so I don't know if there are some that don't do that. But everything is about survival of the fittest. The procreation is survival of the fittest. They want the best genes moving forward. We've socially engineered that out of society, right? Or we're trying to. And we talked a little bit about this when I was growing up, we had playground conflicts.
Yep.
You used to fight it out and you'd get in trouble. There is no doubt about it. But the result of the fight solved the problem, right? Because whoever you had that conflict with, if you were on the losing end, you didn't go back after that person. If you were on the winning end, you just kind of said, look, I don't have to do this because I know I can win this battle, right? We don't have that anymore. And I'm not saying we should bring it back, but I'm just saying we don't have it anymore. So now we have to look at the replacement of that. And that's through education and so forth. But when we look at something so simple and so minor for us, it's coming at a situation either generated by the position of power or the result of a response by the position of power or lack thereof. And then we look at the resolution. And we talked a little bit about this right before the pressing the record button on this. And what are weapons? And why do we have weapons? And why are they there? And weapons, regardless of the type of weapon, they were developed and or brought to the equation as an equalizer or to get an advantage. And so when people are at a disadvantage, then they try to find something that will give them the advantage. And if we're in a school setting and we're not addressing that imbalance some way, somehow, then by nature, we're going to try to figure a way to take that advantage back, right? We talked about that first grader and that fourth grader and there was a position of power because the fourth grader, this was the kickball incident, right?
Yeah.
That we've talked about a couple of times. And the first grader who was at a disadvantage chose to say something that she thought would get her the advantage. So that was the whole thing there. So I'm not a psychologist, don't claim to be. I'm not a behavioralist, don't claim to be. But we have to understand this is fundamentally why this is happening.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's sad. It is that we can't resolve conflict civilly, that we can't resolve that stuff civilly. And we can't look at the preying on other people as wrong. But that's the bottom line. And we have to figure that out.
Yep.
But once again, number one reason that are being stated by survivors, the subject of an active shooter who survived, number one is bullying. The interesting thing to me is most experts will say that this is a uniquely American issue. The frequency is, right. The actual acts are not.
Right.
And some people would likely argue the frequency is not even uniquely American because we have such a larger population.
Right. You gotta look at the ratio and
the real
numbers.
Yeah, and that kind of stuff. So I'm not saying that we don't have a problem, but I will argue that it's not uniquely American. Lots of people have this problem, but politics being what they are.
Yep. So Kelly, you wanted to talk about something that was on your mind today. You're just gonna throw it at me.
I'm gonna throw it at you. Yep. We're gonna roll with it. You know, I had a question posed to me the other day by Jim, one of our founders and our chief product officer. And he was asking me, he says, there are so many small schools and there's a big gap between resources between the small schools and the larger schools and the ability to protect themselves. There's this big gap. And I said, well, yeah, that's pretty obvious. Funding, all of that stuff is, you know, every time they spend a dollar, it's a higher percentage of their overall budget when you're talking about a small school, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And so there's funding gaps, there's resource gaps, there's all of these things. And he said, you know, we need to address that. And I said, there's literally only one way to do that, and that's to treat the schools, the smaller schools, not as individuals, but as either a consortium or regionally bringing other schools together that can share resources and funding and things like that. And there's some grants that would impact that. But then he brought up this other question, and this is what got me to thinking. And it's not really that I didn't realize this. It's I haven't addressed it. And that's when you talk about the law enforcement and first responders who are also generally, the vast majority of them are small, rural, and those gaps that are generated there. And he said, you know, how do we address that, Kelly? And I said, same way, except for it's easier to do it from a law enforcement and or first responder perspective, because generally speaking, they have MOUs already in place. They understand that. Schools don't. Schools don't understand that if you have one school building, K through 12, that if you need resources or you need expertise from another school district, they generally don't ask. They just kind of sit in their own silos. So do we need to fix that? Yeah, we do. But when I was talking to Jim, I said, you know, on average, I think the size of a law enforcement agency is like eight.
Eight people?
Eight people.
Wow.
You have the small or the large ones, like New York City's 38,000 cops.
Yeah.
But they're policing 5 million people or whatever that right. population
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And, you know, Boston might have 1,000 cops. Miami, Los Angeles has 10 or 15,000. And then the sheriff's offices in those areas are equally large, maybe not the same numbers, but comparatively so. So there's very few agencies in the United States, even some of the larger ones. My agency had 700 total employees, maybe about 325 sworn deputies, another couple hundred in the jail and the courts. So, you know, five or so hundred sworn people in various capacities. But when you break that down, any given time on patrol, you probably had 20 people, maybe 30. Certainly you would overlap sometimes. You would have some peak hours, weekends, nights, you know, those kinds of things. But having the ability to respond to an incident like this takes a lot of resources. The incident that I was the incident commander for, at some point in that response and investigation, we had over 250 different cops, sworn people, not to mention all of the support people. We had 250 law enforcement people touch that incident in some manner, most of which was the initial response.
Wow.
Right?
That's a lot of people to manage.
Right? That's not only a lot of people to manage, but it's
wow.
Goes to show you how many resources are necessary. Of course, we had a unique situation. Ours was not contained in a single building. Ours was one of the first active shooters to go mobile, and he was driving all around shooting and running over people. So from that perspective, it's difficult for us to identify that gap, and we have to understand that. And you know, when you talk about the other first responders, and you're talking about the fire department and the emergency medical services, EMS, 80% of them are volunteer agencies. So, you know, chances are they're little more than weekend warriors. They're people who have this sense of duty that are volunteering. I'm not downplaying the necessity of having them, but they're not well-funded. They're probably, I don't know, so I'm going to assume that they're well-trained because you have to have training to be certified as an agency and respond or capable of doing things. So especially in the fire service, but that's when you're talking about 80% of all fire departments and ambulances services being in medical emergency medical services being volunteer, that's a big gap, right? So how do we fix that? How do we bring that together? And again, it's bringing in MOUs, understanding that. And so when we look at the responsibility of the school and what they are doing or not doing, as we have talked about throughout this journey of making your school safer and doing it, we've talked about who's ultimately responsible for the safety of their kids. Superintendents, school boards, principals, school safety directors, right? Those people who are by policy and or expectation in control of that school or that district, right? And their safety program. At the same time, we get a lot of pushback as to not my area of expertise. I don't have a budget. I don't have the time. I don't know where to start. We have all of these issues. And yet for the last year plus, we've been trying to articulate that. And when Jim posed these questions to me, I said, you know what? I think I'm getting this wrong. And I'm not sure that our schools are capable. And, you know, I've made the assumption that all they need is a paradigm shift and we could start moving in the right direction. And when I say not capable. Certainly they're capable, but they have to want to do it. They have to do all of these things that we've asked. And when we start talking to our schools about who are their safety people and what their expectations are when they press the alert button, what do we get?
When they press the button, it's, if I press this button, I'm going to get help.
Yep. I'm going to get help and somebody's going to come save me. Right. And I've been working at from the perspective that our schools want to set the standard and understand when they press that button, who's coming to help them and what are those people going to do when they arrive? And I think that's where I was wrong. I don't think they care. I think, and I'm going to get a lot of pushback for that. No doubt about it. I'm going to get a lot of people who say, of course we care. Well, if you cared, then your actions and your budgets would reflect that, and they don't. So what I think they do when they press that button is they want somebody to come save them. Now, when we talk to the law enforcement side, and the first responder side, what is the number one problem that they see from the schools?
I would guess, I mean, my exposure is pretty limited, but I would guess that it's that the schools want as little police involvement as possible.
In some cases, that's not the number one, but when they press the button and they are interacting with the schools, law enforcement's number one complaint is, I want them on the same sheet of music. We need to be on the same sheet of music.
Okay. So you were talking about like a specific incident type of situation.
Situation. Yeah. Maybe I wasn't clear on that.
Okay.
But when this law enforcement gets called for any reason to a school, it's because the school either has a policy or what have you that they have to, or a law that they have to, or they want somebody to come solve their problem for them. And law enforcement comes in and they're like, we need to do this. Well, we can't do that. Well, this is the problem you asked me to solve, and this is the way I'm going to solve this problem. Yeah, but there's so much, well, we're not on the same sheet of music here. And that transcends into emergencies. I need you to do this. Yeah, we don't know how to do that. Or we were thinking that you would just come in and solve this whole problem for us. Or I don't have the expertise. I don't have whatever, right? So as I'm thinking through this, I'm saying, you know what? Law enforcement and the fire department should drive this. If we are the ones that are going to come solve that problem, and we're the ones when they push the big red button, when they push that, we expect certain things to occur. What are they? And I think law enforcement and fire service and the emergency medical services, they need to sit down and drive that. Go to their schools and say, look, here's what we're going to do. And if the schools don't like it, they need to say, look, we can't do that because of this or because of that, and work at it from a different perspective, but ending up with the same results. You need to understand what you need to do during this type of event, because you're going to call us and we're going to expect you to be in this mode. And if you want us to come and work together, then we're going to do it this way, and we're going to help you, and you're going to help us, and we're going to do this. So I think there's this need to bring everyone together. The schools are reluctant for whatever reason to reach out to law enforcement. I understand the politics behind having even SROs on campus. Understand that. But that should not extend to the emergency situations, the safety plans, those types of things, right?
Yep.
It may, and I'm sure the schools don't have the ability to necessarily separate those politics, but they need to. They need to figure that out. And I think that the law enforcement and the fire departments and the whoever's going to respond, because here's the other thing. If our average size law enforcement agency is 8 and you have a 24/7 response service, you have one or two people working every day. So what does that mean? State police are coming. Sheriff's departments are coming. I call them fish and game, conservation, wildlife cops, whatever you call them, they're coming. Federal agencies are coming. They're going to be slow because they're, well, it sounds like I'm joking, but it's just
I thought you were making a dig at them.
No, well, I can if you want. it's just because they're not right there.
Yeah.
Right. They're usually in the larger populated areas, and then they get farmed out to the smaller or the less populated areas. But they're going to come. Your court cops, your DA investigators, all of these different agencies are going to show up. So they need to understand that. And, you know, when I talk to schools, smaller districts, you know, I get, oh, the sheriff's department takes care of our stuff. Okay. But they're a small sheriff's department. Who else is coming? Oh, the state police. Okay, great. Well, you can see just by the way they say it, they believe that the state police is going to have all these resources. They do somewhere and likely somewhere else, right? In, you know, a small county or a small rural county, you might have a single state trooper or a state police guy for 3 or 4 counties, just because that's the nature of everyday law enforcement. So understand what those resources are, have the cops drive that, have the fire departments do the same thing. If 80% of your fire and medical emergency agencies are volunteer, what does that look like? Get them all together. And I think this is something that, you know, maybe I've gotten it wrong, maybe not, but I think there's this from the perspective of the schools, they think that law enforcement drives this and law enforcement isn't, for lots of reasons. They have resource shortages as well. And there's a lot of politics being played right now. And so somebody's going to have to put those politics aside and move forward. And, you know, I think that's kind of where maybe if we're going to address this, we have to address it from that perspective, probably both sides. You know, if you're willing to go into the knock on the door of the sheriff's department and say, hey, I'm so-and-so from the school, I need your help, they're not going to refuse it. They're just not going to. But if you're not willing to do that, then, you know, I'm speaking to all of my emergency response agencies, all my brethren in law enforcement, and all of my, dare I say, friends in the fire service. You guys need to get together and solve this problem for them. You need to figure it out. And you need to walk in and be willing to knock on the door of the school district and say, look, we have to figure this out. We're going to do our part, and this is what we expect. And hopefully that'll start that conversation. Again, I think we need to, I'm not necessarily wrong, but I was wrong. I think there's evidence, I've seen it, that the schools rely on like their school resource officers for good reasons to do that. But we've talked about this, and we have to understand that not all cops have the same capabilities, same understanding, especially when we're working on planning and so forth, and execution and training and all of that stuff. school resource officers, unless you're from a large agency, they're likely very low level response people. And that's one of their primary duties during an active violence situation is to respond to that incident and isolate that threat. If they're doing that, they are no longer available to help you manage that incident and go through it. And in fact, once everyone else gets there and the situation's been stabilized, however you define that, depending on the way that it was stabilized, I'm likely going, as an incident commander or a commanding officer, I'm likely going to pull that SRO out of the equation entirely for many reasons. I will say this, even if I was wrong in the pathway to get there, I am not wrong in who's responsible for, I'm not wrong. And we're seeing this and we're going to see it more and more. I am not wrong in who is ultimately responsible for the safety of those students. And in most cases, legally.
Yeah.
You can't say you don't have that responsibility and then say in the next sentence that when I'm at school as an administrator, I am legally the parent of that child in absentia or whatever they call that. In the absence of the parent, they are the parent.
Right. Yeah, you're essentially the guardian. The duty to care for the child has been transferred from the parent to the teacher or whoever once they are in that
school. To educator, school to the school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Legally, it's been done. So as soon as you drop your, the parent drops the kid off, the school has that responsibility by law. There you go. I'm not wrong there. So, no. You know, and we can't be selective on what that means. Just like a parent, you have the duty to keep that kid safe. So there you go.
So I think one of my thoughts through this is, I 100% agree with you just based off of everything I see online, even, you know, people that I know that are in schools. It's like, there's a lot of schools that they're behind in.
That's such a nice way to say it.
I'm trying to be nice, but it's like the resources that they have are very limited compared to any other organization, right? Every other organization has advanced in their way of looking at things, advanced in the technology that they're using. And it's like, there's schools that are still filing documents with paper, and then they store that physical paper in storage lockers. Some schools will pay to have five some years records stored in storage lockers, mm-hmm. physical papers, and they're paying to store that in a storage locker. That's a real thing. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? But anyways, what I want to get to is that, like, I think there are some schools that are doing it right. I think there are some schools that are actually doing everything they can to make these steps to put together these protective, you know, elements in their schools. There's some schools that are adding, you know, the, you know, AI wherever they can, you know, gun detection and state-of-the-art cameras and whatever else they need. And this is what I want to say to those schools, is that if you're doing it right, we need you to be very vocal. We need you to be like champions of, like, hey, this is what happens when you do things right. Here are the benefits, because here's what's going to happen if you don't. Nothing's going to change. We're going to be in the 50-year anniversary of Columbine, and nothing will change, because the people who are doing it right are not championing school safety enough. That's my charge.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. Fundamentally, there's even an issue at the school level of defining who is responsible and what those expectations are. And you mentioned Columbine. We're recording this on the 3rd of April, 2024. And we normally don't say when we're recording it, but it's important here because we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of Columbine. And we still have states and schools that don't mandate safety directors or safety coordinators, whatever you want to call them, in the schools, right?
Sad.
That's fundamentally, that is a huge issue, right? Because it's those people who are, regardless of how they're being driven, what's driving them, whether it's their own personal desire or a newly acquired job or what have you, or they have this acuity to do this kind of work. But fundamentally, if you don't have that person, then you're behind the eight ball. And we're 25 years out from Columbine.
25 years.
25 years this year. And it baffles me, frankly. You know, it frustrates me.
The way I see it is like, you know, I'm big into cars. So like, I think back 25 years ago, what cars look like. Like, I don't, maybe it wasn't quite 25 years. Maybe it was 30 some years. Well, no, it probably might have been 25 years. I remember 25 years ago, give or take a couple of years, riding in the back of my parents' station wagon in the seats. It was one of those Buick station wagons where it's like, got like the yep. fake wood grain on the sides and the seats were literally facing backwards.
Backwards.
Mm-hmm. And like, it's like, you don't see that today because it's like incredibly unsafe. It's like terrible.
Right.
And it's like, okay, how come, like, you look back at 25 years ago and like how far the automobile industry has come. Why are we putting so much attention? Like, there's some things it's like, okay, did you really need that? Meh, okay, you could argue. I mean, the airbag stuff and all the safety parts of an automobile, sure, that's great, wonderful. But it's like, why are we not putting that much effort into school safety?
Well, I don't think it's it can be looked at that way, right? Because people put development into things for two reasons primarily, profit and yeah. interest,
right?
Sure. And your interest in cars is going to drive somebody to develop something that makes them money, right?
There's no money in protecting children.
Well, I was just going to say, we see it in our industry.
Yeah.
But it's getting the end user to adopt is and understand the need for the advancements. The amount of technology advancements in the last, so I've been specifically in the school safety arena for the last 6 years. The amount of technology advancement is huge. In the last 4 years for Crisis Go, huge.
Yeah.
Right? And understanding the need and how that all works is huge. And you need somebody who is responsible for that. Understanding how do we make it more efficient? You mentioned paper. People are still using paper to document stuff, and it's in a file that literally transfers when the kid gets transferred. And nobody goes through that file to see what's in there until there's a problem, right? And nowadays, although there's let me just say this. Nowadays, the technology is available for us to analyze and interpret that type of data at the push of a button.
Yep.
If it's set up correctly, right? We have the ability to analyze and alert people that are in your building. We have the technology, although it's not being used for this, to track who and how many people and where they're at in a building, right? So accounting for kids during an emergency, that's there, right? So accounting for who's in your building during an emergency, we have that capabilities, those capabilities. So yeah, I mean, there is, we talked about this before. I believe at some point we have to start developing the profession of school safety people.
Mm.
Right? We've talked about that before. Well, yes, but there is, I bet you, yeah, I'll bet you this. I'll How bet much? You. Well, there are very few, a very small percentage, and I would almost say zero of our school safety experts and safety directors graduated high school and said, you know what? I want to be a school safety director.
Hmm. Okay. I'd probably agree with you on that one.
I'm going to go to school to be a school safety director. I bet what ended up happening, and this is maybe the crux of the entire issue with school safety, is those people who have a propensity for school safety stumbled upon it because of an assignment, something other than that being their primary goal and function.
Mm.
Right. And we talked about the need for higher education to develop programs for this. They did it with, there's programs, lots of programs now for certified emergency managers. There's 2-year degrees, 4-year degrees, there are certifications, right? And that all started back after Katrina and the need to have people identified that who can manage incidences. There is, in that quest, there is no difference between being able to do that. I mean, the curriculum is different, but the need is no different from when we did that to school safety professionals. Understanding the intricacies of all of these relationships between different systems, the need to have time and training and budgeting and all of those things, all of those different systems working together is crazy huge. And I think that's where we need to get to. So there's a need for that, but that's where we're at right now.
So maybe in your next life, you're a school safety professor.
Well, it's not really my next life because I'm not that yet. Probably will not be that. I'm on the shorter side of life. Let's say that remaining. But that being said, there's efforts to do that. I think it's too early to say exactly where we're headed with that, but there are efforts in that vein, trying to work through that. But it is so over needed. Because we have to drive, and here's the other thing. We're going to get there. Maybe not in my lifetime, but we're going to get there, and we cannot afford business as usual when somebody says, oh yeah, we need that. We need a professional school safety dude or dudette person to come in and handle our safety and our security. We cannot afford to say, oh, that's their job, not mine. Their job is going to be making sure that everyone is on board with building a safety culture, a positive environment, all of those things we've talked about. And you cannot just hire a safety coordinator, a director of safety, and say, oh, we're good.
Right. You can't just do it just to check off a box. It's not how it works.
Right. So what did we talk about? The three pillars, right?
Systems, policies, and people.
People, right? Policies and systems.
I'm gonna give it
this, Kelly. Right? you're getting better, right? We're going to drive this home. And we're going to, your next life might be a school safety director. I'm going to develop homeschool curriculum for that.
Sure.
Why? Sure. Sure. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's where we need to go. I think
pretty good.
Yeah. I do think that's where we're headed. I know we're headed that way, but I do think that it's going to take some doing. It may go much faster than I think it is, but
I sure hope so.
Yeah. And I just think that there's a need for it from a professional certification degree perspective. In fact, you can get in emergency management, I think you can now get a doctorate in it. I know you can get a master's in it, but I think you can get a doctorate in it as well. But anyway, I do think that from a school safety perspective, I think I just don't understand why it hasn't occurred yet. So we'll work towards that.
We're working on a lot of stuff.
You're working on a lot of stuff.
I am working on a lot of stuff. It's all good.
Did you come up with a question for me?
I did not. I'm trying to think of something that's relevant to what you
were just talking about. I can't give you a hint because that throws off the whole. If I give you a question, that throws off the whole.
It's gotta be something you don't know. This could be something that we just clip out. But I'm putting myself in a parent's shoes. Let's say I have a kid in school, and this is applicable to most schools. Let's say most public schools. And I am a parent who is trying to learn about school safety. Maybe I'm a parent who's even gone out and listened to the wonderful Coffee with Kelly podcast, and I've learned all this awesome information. Why does it seem that schools are so concentrated on other non-academic programs and put so much time and money into those, as opposed to school safety initiatives? How can I, as a parent, drive that? How do I say, hey, I think you should go this direction a little bit more than this other direction that you're going, without being totally, hopefully you understand what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So first of all, be a voice for that, right? Go to the board meetings, go to the schools and be the voice for that. I would always start with, where on your priorities do you set school safety and the safety of my child? Where do you put that? Inevitably, you're going to get what response to that?
They're going to say safety is our number one priority.
That's exactly what they're going to say. And then I would follow that up with, okay, why can I just walk into this room? Why can I do this? Why do we spend more money? And I'll use my example on a single football game at a single high school than we do on the entire school safety budget for the district. Why is that? It might not be the case in your district, but maybe it is. But you have a concern for a reason. Try to figure out and fish through that and fish out why that concern is there. You have, if you're concerned about your child going to school, why? And don't accept the number one. It's our number one priority. Have them show that to you. And I will tell you, I think I told you this before. I sat on a panel, school safety panel for a district in Missouri. They had a parents' night and they asked if I would come. And so I sat on a panel. And one of the parents said, what are you doing to keep our kids safe? Oh, we have a plan. Oh yeah, what is that plan? Well, it's in a 3-inch binder and we work with our law enforcement. Oh, okay. And I'm sitting back saying, I know what's in those 3-inch binders. That parent does not. And I'll bet you that school administrator who answered that question that way does not. And I will bet you that law enforcement officer who was sitting next to that administrator does not. Don't accept, here's the binder. because that, even if that binder is complete and right on point, unless you know what's in it and how to apply it during every situation or any situation, then they're no better off. And that's where we often find the biggest gap, is the gap between having something by a mandate and understanding how to apply it. Again, during this conversation I had with Jim that we talked about earlier, we talked about one of the biggest gaps. I've been to lots and lots of training. Lots of training by federal agencies in this whole arena of school safety, threat management, threat identification, case management, all of this stuff. I've been to lots of training that way. I've put on some training that way for that. And when you talk to the attendees, they come out of those with this kind of thought. What great training. That was fantastic. What do I do next? Where do I start? And if you look at the amount of effort that they're asking for during those trainings, I'm not disagreeing with anything that they said, but from a school's perspective, that's overwhelming, especially when if you talk about doing a single threat assessment and the amount of effort that it takes to do that and do it properly. And then you multiply that by 100, 200, 300, whatever your school population is, your case management population is, that becomes a very daunting task, especially if you don't know where to start. So you have to understand how to apply it and get to those people, get some resources, figure it out, because you have to do it. And this goes back to, if you think law enforcement is handling it as a school, you need to go to law enforcement and say, hey, how are we going to do this? Don't just say, oh, we gotcha. We train for it. Okay. I haven't been at that training. I don't understand what you're going to do. I don't know where my role starts and stops and your role starts and stops, and how do they mesh together during an incident?
If you enjoyed today's episode, please like, subscribe, and hit that notification bell. And if you have any questions about what we discussed, leave a comment on our website at crisisgo.com. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next time on Coffee with Kelly, a discussion on school safety.